Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
AIG, as you know, owes taxpayers billions and billions and billions of dollars. So the insurance company is selling off big slices of itself to raise some cash, which does kind of raise the question of what's left. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 8th of March today. You know, it's been a good long while since AIG has generated as many headlines as it has the past week or so. In the year plus since its $180 billion government bailout, AIG has brought us a bonus scandal or two, and we are all more familiar than we'd care to be with AIG's credit default swaps. But we haven't really heard much about how the company is going to pay back what it owes until right now. In the second big deal in less than a week, AIG said yesterday it's going to sell off one of its biggest divisions, American Life Insurance Company, to MetLife for about $15 billion. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explores what's left of the insurance company that everybody loves to hate.
Add the $15 billion AIG will get from yesterday's sale to another $35 billion for selling American International Assurance to the British company Prudential, and you get an AIG that is still large and complicated, but, as Morningstar analyst Bill Bergman says, just not as large and complicated as it was 2 weeks ago.
You know, the cash proceeds from these transactions are going to be significant. They're going to pay back about half the debt that they owe to the government, and that's a huge amount of money.
But Bergman says AIG will still have a tab of at least $40 billion. Ron Shelp was a senior officer at AIG for many years, and he's written a book on the company called Falling Giant. He says AIG has some other big components to sell off, including the largest aircraft leasing business in the world.
But the real name of the game is they have to earn money from running their insurance business over the next few years.
Meaning Chartis, their newly renamed property and casualty insurance business. Sharp says, with a focus on that,
they'll be sort of like they were when they started back in 1919 in Shanghai, basically a company that represents American companies and then sells insurance for them in China, only still operating all over the world.
Analysts say with that business model and more restructuring, AIG may eventually be in a position to pay back taxpayers in full. That's a prospect that seemed almost impossible on that September morning in 2008 when AIG was saved by you and me. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The director of the Congressional Budget Office waved a big red flag about another economic stimulus package today. Douglas Elmendorf said out loud what seems to be crystal clear, that any more government spending is only going to expand the already wide federal budget gap. And not everybody is benefiting from last year's stimulus bill either. Businesses owned by minorities and women are getting just a small slice of that $787 billion. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports from Washington.
Harry Alford has seen it before. Federal money gravitating to the same group of large, well-connected businesses. Alford heads the National Black Chamber of Commerce. He says it's like pigs to a trough.
You put more feed in the trough, but you got the same pigs eating, so nothing changes.
Alford says in the rush to shovel stimulus money into the economy, no cash was set aside for minority-owned businesses. Most of the federal stimulus money went to the states. They awarded contracts for projects like road work and bridge repair. Alford says the contracts were distributed through well-greased old boy networks.
They're designed for a few large businesses who wine and dine the procurement personnel at the state level.
For example, just 6% of the Federal Highway Administration stimulus money the states awarded went to women and minority-owned businesses. These firms aren't big enough to compete for large projects. They don't have access to funding and equipment. And to make matters worse, when they lose a contract, it's hard to find out who did win. Stephen Boykevich is with the Transportation Equity Network.
There's no single outlet where members of communities that may be underserved in the allocation of stimulus contracts can go and see, okay, exactly where did this money go?
The Obama administration is trying to convince the states to award more contracts to minority businesses, and it's starting to take action. It's withholding money from San Francisco's transit agency until it hires more minority contractors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
All righty then. With the real news out of the way, on to what was actually talked about around the water cooler today. What happened last night at the Oscars, of course. Yeah, there were the dresses and the speeches and whatever it was that the hosts did. But, you know, as Academy Awards go, there weren't a whole lot of surprises, at least not during the show. The commercials were another story, especially that perfume ad. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
A woman lounges on a couch in a chiffon dress. She sees twinkling lights dancing in front of her and runs to follow them. They lead her to a ballroom. She twirls around smiling. In the mist, she sees a pink perfume bottle. It spins around to reveal the words, cervical cancer.
Maybe it's unfair to get your attention this way, but nothing's fair about cervical cancer. But there are ways to prevent it.
Namely Gardasil, a vaccine made by GlaxoSmithKline, which ran the ad.
I have to say that the ad definitely stopped me in my tracks.
Tracy Chapman is a consultant for marketing firm Just Ask a Woman. She says the ad's an attention getter. It never mentions Gardasil. Rather, it directs you to an informational website for cervical cancer.
We could see this as a public service announcement, but we're smart enough to know that there's a product on the end. But I think allows women to feel good about choosing that brand because of what the company has offered them.
Pfizer just set up a similar site for fibromyalgia. And yes, the company has a drug that treats that. Michael Birkin is a brand strategist with Red Peak. He says the public service approach helps drug companies avoid listing a litany of hair-raising side effects, and it makes them look virtuous.
It's performing a public service as well as helping sell your product. And I suspect it is an approach that we're going to see more of.
By creating go-to information sites and online communities, companies can create strong relationships with consumers. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The major indices couldn't really decide on their message today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Everybody's different in how we handle what life gives us. Some of us actively make choices that could change an outcome. Others might just let things play out, see what happens. That's what you might call the default to actually doing something. With the president in Pennsylvania today talking up health care reform, we thought we'd look at how the default trigger might affect the decisions that doctors make and the tests that they then order for their patients. Duke University professor Dan Ariely is here to help us do that. Dan, good to talk to you again.
Same here.
All right, so let's define a term, I suppose, to start with. What do you mean when you say default?
Okay, so default is the option that we get when we don't do anything physically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so whatever was decided before us is what we will continue doing. So if you think about savings, for example, if you have an automatic withdrawal from your checking account to savings every month, that's the default. It will happen without any action. On the other hand, if you don't have one of these drafted, a default is that you're not going to save.
Okay, so tell me about your research. What did you guys do?
There's a huge literature on default. I think one of the cutest papers is about pizzas. So imagine that I give you two menus. Some people, I give a menu that starts with all the toppings, and the other menu starts with no topping, and you have to add toppings to it.
All right.
The default in the first one is that you'll get a fully loaded pizza.
Right.
The default in the second one, you get pizza just with cheese.
Right.
What happened is that people end up with a very different number of toppings. People who started with the pizza with all the toppings end up with lots and lots of toppings. People who started with empty pizza basically get one or two. And of course, the financial outcome for the pizza place is very different. But we wanted to look at this in the domain of physicians ordering tests.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to hospital these days or to visit your physician, you will see that they have these electronic order forms.
Right.
And they basically use those to order tests for you. And sometimes these order forms are empty. Nothing is selected for them. The default is nothing, and they have to pick what they want to order. And sometimes some tests are pre-selected for them. So we created scenarios in which we described to physicians, some patients who arrive at the ER, and we asked them to decide what test to give them. And to half of the physicians, we gave the fully loaded options, like the pizza. And for the other half, we gave them one that were empty, and they had to check which one they wanted to do.
Now, did this involve actual patient care? Because you can see how healthcare in this country gets so expensive when you guys are doing tests like this.
It didn't involve actual patient care. But of course, the implications are for actual patient care. These were actual physicians.
Right.
They were making hypothetical decisions.
Okay.
But, you know, you could imagine how the same thing would play
out if
somebody built that system. And the basic result was that in the empty set, physicians chose on average 5 tests. And in the full set, they chose on average 13 tests.
Wow.
And the difference was about $1,300 per patient. Right. So now, if you think about it, these information systems are going to roll out into hospitals in all kinds of ways. And I think they have tremendous influence on what the physicians will decide.
Forget about cost for a second. This actually, it sort of influences what specific tests there are, right? Because you have, in essence, with this fully loaded sheet, a recommendation for these tests.
That's right. So one of the reasons for this effect of the default is that people read it as an implicit recommendation. They said, if somebody checked all of these for us, it must be the case that this is a good thing to do or something I need to do. Or in the physician case, you can even imagine that they think that if they don't do it, somebody would go ahead and sue them. And as a consequence, this fulfillment system could have tremendous effect on what tests eventually get executed.
So is the moral of the story, don't get stuck in a rut, right? I mean, question what you do systematically.
I think that's a very good moral, right? So if you say, how much of what I'm doing is just because I've done it before and it's the default versus this is the decision I actually want to arrive at?
Dan Ariely, he teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy sees economic opportunity in nuclear power. France gets about 80% of its electricity from splitting atoms. They have a robust nuclear industry there. So when Sarkozy told a conference in Paris today that nuclear is a great way to help third world countries fight climate change, you can safely infer that he would prefer those countries buy French technology. Here at home, meanwhile, President Obama is trying to give U.S. nuclear power a new lease on life. Last month, he announced an $8 billion loan guarantee for 2 reactors in Georgia. He wants another $50 billion to jumpstart an industry that's been on the decline since Three Mile Island back in 1979. One of nuclear's biggest drawbacks, though, is the multi-billion dollar price tag for all those new reactors. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports now on a way to make nuclear affordable.
Call them mini nukes. A handful of companies in the U.S. are designing nuclear power reactors that could fit in your backyard. Well, sort of.
12, 15 feet wide by about 75 feet tall.
That's Chris Mowry, CEO of Babcock & Wilcox Modular Nuclear Energy out of Virginia. His company already has some experience with smaller reactors. Babcock started making nuclear reactors for Navy submarines back in the 1950s.
Our idea is, hey, let's make that nuclear reactor in a factory where it can be done with higher quality and lower cost and then ship it to the field on a rail car. So really, we're talking about something that's about a tenth of the size of a typical large reactor.
Of course, that means they produce a fraction of the electricity as well, but still enough to power a small city. But the idea behind these smaller generators is to let a utility add nuclear to its power mix bit by bit. That's instead of investing in one multi-billion dollar reactor that puts the entire company at financial risk. First Energy in Ohio currently generates over a third of its power from 3 large nuclear plants. But spokesman Todd Schneider says his company might be interested in buying smaller reactors in the future, and not just because they're cheaper.
The construction timetable would be shorter. These units would be pretty much prefabricated and then shipped to the site and put in place.
A couple of American startups are working on small reactors, too. One said to be the size of a hot tub. They're counting on renewed interest in nuclear power here. Many utilities see it as a cleaner alternative to their aging coal-fired power plants that fuel global warming. But nuclear regulators have yet to approve any of these mini-nukes, and even if they do, experts don't expect any to go online for at least another decade. Nuclear engineer Paul Wilson at the University of Wisconsin says it's still unclear whether these smaller nukes are economically viable.
I think it relies on large volume production in a factory setting. So if we can't produce them at enough volume, then the economic benefits might not materialize.
Mini nuke makers say these reactors are as safe, if not safer, than existing ones. But nuclear critics aren't appeased. Anna Aurelio is with Environment America.
They're still going to generate a big problem when it comes to radioactive waste. So Environment America does not believe that mini nukes will get us any closer to solving our energy crisis.
Congress still hasn't agreed on a permanent site for burying the country's nuclear waste. But nuclear expert Paul Wilson says these small reactors may end up snagging their first customers overseas in any case. He says they may well suit remote towns and villages in developing countries where the transmission systems can't handle big nuclear reactors. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, will technology kill the trading star?
The cash livestock trade has always been a verbal handshake, word-of-mouth agreement.
The future of hog futures, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked down 13 points today. That's about a 10%, closed at 10,552. The NASDAQ put on 5 points, 0.25%, finished at 2332. The S&P 500 basically flat, finished at 1138. AIG rose 3.75% today. As we mentioned earlier, the troubled insurance company agreed to sell off another huge chunk of its business, this time to MetLife. MetLife, by the way, nosed up 5% today. Mixed day, though, for other financial companies. Goldman Sachs hauled in 1.5%. Morgan Stanley pocketed a 0.5% gain today. McDonald's packed on 2.25% after reporting better than expected global sales last month. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. President Obama meets with the Prime Minister of Greece at the White House. The organization AHIP, that's America's Health Insurance Plans, holds its 2010 National Policy Forum. First meeting on the schedule addresses health reform. And a House subcommittee on military personnel discusses how troop deployment affects kids. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Here's a new idea from the Obama administration. Instead of working overtime to figure out ways to keep homeowners who are in financial trouble in their homes, the White House wants to pay some of them to leave. The New York Times reports today the Obama administration is going to start encouraging short sales, in which the bank takes less for a house than is left due on the mortgage. It's going to sweeten the pot by offering both lenders and homeowners token remuneration to move those deals along. And the plan could, if it works right, help cut down on foreclosures. Commentator David Abramowitz offers some other ideas.
It's 2010 and foreclosures have gone viral. 1 in 7 American families have fallen behind on their mortgage payments. Many others keep paying, but owe more than their homes are worth. And studies show that more than 5 million of these families are hitting a dangerous walkaway point, where it makes more economic sense to just hand over the keys. Despite government incentives, lenders have done little to give homeowners a reason to hang in there. True, recent Obama administration help for hard-hit states is better targeted, but it only goes so far. Congress can't just hope this foreclosure fever will break on its own. We need concrete solutions before our economy gets too sick to recover. Here's three ideas to consider. 1. Mandatory mediation. This has worked well in Philadelphia and Connecticut. Mediation between borrower and lender prior to a foreclosure unclogs courts and achieves faster, cheaper, and better resolutions for all involved. 2. A national foreclosure moratorium. During the Depression, many states temporarily stopped foreclosures. This gave struggling families time to work out a payment plan or maybe even find a job. A national measure today could motivate lenders to offer more aggressive loan modifications. And 3, eliminate the special tax break for mortgage investors. This one is complicated but potentially the most effective. You see, mortgages are actually owned in big pools called Real Estate Mortgage Investment Conduits, REMICs. Investors in REMICs enjoy valuable tax benefits. These tax breaks were intended to encourage private capital to fund homeownership. Yet with shares in REMICs sliced up among so many investors, it's practically impossible to get them to agree on slowing down foreclosures. If instead we eliminate the tax break when a REMIC just keeps foreclosing, they will change course quickly to modify loans whenever possible. All these remedies create consequences for lenders who keep needlessly foreclosing, giving them an incentive to negotiate first. And none of them require more public spending. That's got to be better than staying the course.
David Abramowitz is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Would you? Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. On any given day, millions of contracts are traded at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. You can buy and sell contracts on what you think the weather in Asia is going to be, or how you think the dollar is going to hold up against the Norwegian krona, too. The Chicago Merc, though, is probably best known for its agricultural commodities trades, corn, soybeans, oats, and all of that stuff. Most of the trading happens away from the actual floor of the exchange, on computer screens, because electronics is just faster and more efficient. There are still plenty of traders in the pit wearing their colorful jackets, shouting and waving their arms. Open outcry is what that's called. And one kind of commodity in particular, the four-legged variety, has been slow to make the digital transition. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why.
On the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, dozens of traders mill about, staring up at electronic screens. At precisely 9:05 a.m., they spring to life. This is the Hog Futures Trading Pit. All those shouting people are trading contracts to buy lean hogs at a certain price on a future date. And believe it or not, the crowd is fairly sedate by old standards. More and more of the futures trading in all commodities takes place silently on computer screens. But floor trader James Bugsy Brooks says the livestock markets, cattle and hogs, have been slower to go that way.
The cash livestock trade has always been a verbal handshake, word-of-mouth agreement, and so they were very comfortable still having that personal relationship.
But even these holdouts are changing fast. More than half of cattle futures trading is now electronic. For hogs, it's more like 70%. To understand why, I headed west to hog country. On a farm in Walker, Iowa, Todd Wiley slips coveralls over his jeans and opens a door to a sea of pink. He's greeted by close to 1,000 sows jostling and banging against their gates. It's feeding time.
It's amazing. You come in here at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's like you woke your kid up. You know, they're all groggy and they don't want to do anything. You come in at noon, they just go nuts. They're just happy to be here, I guess.
When Wiley buys corn and soybean meal for feed, he never knows if he'll earn enough money selling his pigs to cover the costs and make a profit. So he hedges. He'll often sell a futures contract on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange that guarantees a price for his hogs.
I'm not a big gambler. I mean, we drive by casinos and my buddies say, you want to stop and play a little bit? And I'm like, I play every day. You know, I just, everything's a gamble and you manage your risk to the best that you can.
But when Wiley buys or sells a contract in Chicago, he doesn't really care if it's traded face-to-face in the trading pit or electronically. He just calls his broker, a guy named Ken Jolliffe in Cedar Rapids.
When he calls me and tells me, you know, what contract he wants to sell, at what price.
Jolliffe's been in the ag business for more than 30 years. He's used to talking to an actual person when making a trade. And just a few years ago, he would have called someone on the trading floor in Chicago to place Wiley's order. Now he just taps a few keys on his computer.
And then it is clicked and sent into the system in our clearinghouse in Chicago.
The thing about trading is you have to go where the volume is, where you're most likely to find a speculator or sausage maker or maybe another hog farmer willing to take the other side of your trade. Jolliffe says as trading in all commodities has moved away from the floor and onto the screen, he's had to follow.
You know, there's a lot of us that are still not as quick on learning how to run the computers. I'm sure there's a little resistance in doing that, but you know, it's kind of like the kids tell you, do it, Dad, so you don't fall behind.
By 10 o'clock on the floor in Chicago, the hog pit has settled down. Traders mostly stand around with the occasional outburst. The livestock pits have been a refuge for traders in other commodities that went electronic faster. But as people like Ken Jolliffe and Cedar Rapids send fewer orders to the floor, traders like Trey Canipa have had to evolve too.
In fact, I probably do 80% of my own volume on the screen. I'll run up to the desk, trade on the screen, go down the pit, trade in the pit, and have them offset each other. So I just have to adapt. That's part of being a trader, is we're the loudest to complain, but we're the first to adapt.
If they keep adapting, even the still rowdy livestock pits will get a lot quieter. In Chicago, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you might have heard about that spat between Cablevision, the New York area cable provider, and the Disney company. Disney wants more cash in return for letting Cablevision carry ABC programming, which, as it happens, was where last night's Oscars were. There were threats and counter-threats about Cablevision pulling ABC off the air. And at 8:30 last night in New York, as the Oscars were starting, Cablevision subscribers weren't seeing it. Of course, a deal was conveniently reached 13 minutes into the broadcast, as you know. But we got to wondering around here this morning why, if they were serious, Cablevision didn't pull the last 15 minutes of the show, where all those big awards are, instead of the first 15. Question worth asking, isn't it? That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow lost 13 points. That is a 10th percent. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.25%. The S&P ended the day basically flat. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, why Greece is hoping it's all for one and one for all.
If you get in this Eurozone, you abolish your national sovereignty. We are not free.
All right, that's one point of view. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for the other side tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.